Hey, everybody, this is Charles Maxwood with Teach Me to Code, and this week I'm here with the, what do you call yourself, the project chairman?
Project chair.
Project chair of Cassandra, Jonathan Ellis. Now, Jonathan and I actually worked together a few years ago, and so he's been kind enough to come onto the podcast and talk about Cassandra and about DataStax, which is a company that he co-founded and is working at. So, Jonathan, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll get into the interview.
Sure. So after I left Mosey, where you and I worked together, I went to work for Rackspace, who hired me to basically lead a team to build a distributed scalable database. And so my approach was to look at the different open source projects at the time and take one of those to get behind, because basically what Rackspace was doing was, they're getting to the point where they're starting to compete with, Amazon and Google, and they're playing with the big boys in the cloud space. And so they realized that they need to have the kind of next generation infrastructure that those companies have and have written papers about. And so, they didn't want to try to duplicate the kind of in-house proprietary infrastructure exactly, but rather be part of a more open infrastructure. And you've seen that with some of their other projects with OpenStack and so forth, that they really get open source and they want to use that as the foundation of their next generation stuff. And so so I looked at what was out there, and at the time you had not just the ones that are around today, like HBase and Voldemort and MongoDB, but you also had some that you don't see anymore, like Dynamite and a couple others. And my assessment was that Cassandra at the time had just been open sourced by Facebook and really had the best technical foundation. But the risk was that Facebook kind of has a track record of open sourcing projects, and not, for whatever reason, they're not super interested in leading those projects after they open source them, not necessarily. So some of the projects have kind of faltered that they've open sourced. Others, like Thrift, kind of hit their second wind when more non-Facebook contributors started stepping in and contributing. So the risk was that, as I saw it, that Facebook would lose interest and not help build the community. And as it turned out, that's basically what happened. But before they walked away, they did get Cassandra into the Apache Foundation. And at that point, I was involved. I became the first non-Facebook committer. When we graduated, I became the project chair, and we kind of took it from there. So basically what a lot of people don't realize is that Facebook got Cassandra to where they needed it for what they were using it for, and then basically said, okay, it's good, enjoy, and we're moving on to other things. So it's very much an open source success story in that respect, which it's one of the few projects that I can think of that survived and even thrived after its original authors have moved on.
Right. That's really interesting. So do you know where it's being used now? Is it being used it seems like it's being used quite a bit outside of Facebook. Do you have any examples of companies out there that the audience may have heard of that's using it?
One of the big ones is Netflix. So I guess first it started off in kind of the social media sphere. So you had Facebook, you had Dig, you had Twitter, you had Reddit, second tier ones like Mahalo. Kind of in that niche. And then as it matured, more companies that were not quite as willing to live on the bleeding edge started getting into it. So kind of the second wave includes companies like Netflix, like Injimoco, like Cisco, companies like that. You know, it's really become a tool that gets used across a lot of industries. Advertising is another one, with companies like OpenX, enterprise messaging with things like Constant Contact and Jive. So very Urban Airship, another one in the messaging space. So very, very broad appeal.
Huh. So I guess my next question is what are they using it for? Or what sorts of things is Cassandra geared well toward?
So basically what it targets is applications where you need high scalability, high performance, and bulletproof availability. That's really what it's shooting at. And if you have an application that, you know, falls into that category, then you should probably use Cassandra. Now, there's a couple places where we could say, well, we see people using it for time series data, and we see that an awful lot.
What do you mean by time series data?
So by that I mean events that, you know, are coming in over time, and you want to analyze those in terms of that chronological stream. So for instance, CloudKick monitors servers using Cassandra. So they were a startup that does, they basically do cloud monitoring. You could sign up with them and install a daemon on your servers, and it would send telemetrics to basically a service built on Cassandra that would record those and be able to tell you, no, here's your server's history of I/O, here's your history of CPU usage, and so forth. And then actually Rackspace acquired them fairly recently.
Oh, interesting.
That's one example of time series data. Another example is Twitter built their real-time tweet analytics engine called Rainbird on top of Cassandra. So that's another example of stuff where, you know, when somebody views a tweet, when somebody retweets a tweet, you know, these kind of actions that you want to record and analyze as a function of time. Another example would be sensor data for hardware stuff. With companies that are doing analysis of that kind of data, you know, a lot of them are using Cassandra as well. So the time series data, that's one kind of broad category that I could point to. Another one would be kind of user activity logs, where, you know, I have some kind of web property, and when the user takes an action on that, when he views a page, when he puts an item in his cart, I want to track those. Maybe I want to just analyze those as a whole. Maybe I want to say, this user has this other group of friends that he wants to share these actions with and interact with people that way. So that would be another category of general kind of, I've right. noticed a bit of a trend there.
All right. And that, you know, those are all just interesting applications, things that I think a lot of us have done something similar to in one way or another, where we're collecting information about, you know, stuff that's happening out there. You know, we bring it into the database. I think a lot of the people that I talk to, though, have done most of that with a relational database, something like MySQL or PostgreSQL. And one thing that appealed to me with Cassandra was its distributed nature and the fact that you can kind of pull all of the nodes at once and get all of the information back. It seems to read more quickly, and from what I understand, it's write optimized, not read optimized. Do you want to talk about some of the trade-offs with that?
With a system like Cassandra that's aimed more at the real-time side of big data, we want to avoid having to touch all the nodes to do a read. What we want to do is we want to be able to say, oh, your data that you're asking for lives on, you know, say, these three nodes out of this cluster of 100. And so that way, I can scale by adding nodes. Whereas if every read touches every node, then adding more nodes, you know, doesn't help me scale as much.
Right.
So about the performance aspect on the, you know, at the machine level, Cassandra uses a log-structured storage engine. And so what that means is when writes come in to Cassandra, the first thing we do is we append them to a commit log. Cassandra offers full durability. We think that's the main part of ACID from traditional databases that is important not to give up. When Cassandra tells you that, yes, I have committed this write, then it really means it.
Right.
So if you lose power or, you know, whatever, you know, there's a, you know, you've misconfigured your system and the Linux killer terminates the Cassandra process with prejudice, you know, whatever, you know, the data is safe. So the first thing we do is we put it in the commit log, and then what we do is we save up that update to a given table, or what we call them in Cassandra, a given column family. And when we have enough changes to that column family, we stream those updates out into a new data file. And we do that with sequential I/O. We're not doing any overwrites. We're just streaming out a new data file. So what I might have, if I have a bunch of updates, maybe I'm storing user information and I had an update that says, you know, update user set email address equals jls@datastacks.com, where username equals Jonathan, right? So what I would have in that new data file is a row for user Jonathan with a single column in it that says column email and value jls@datastacks.com. So it's a sparse engine as well as log structure. So I don't have to have that whole row in that update I have. I just have whatever columns got changed. And then if I come in and I say now select star from users where username is Jonathan, then what I would do is I would pull, you know, the email from that newest version of that column that I just wrote in the new data file, and I would merge that with whatever columns I had in any older data files. So that's kind of where there's some truth to saying that Cassandra's write optimized, because when you go to do a read, you can you'll pull these versions of the row from different data files, so it can be less efficient on reads. That said, popular reporting, if you will, has given, I think, a little too much weight to that and kind of taken a mental shortcut and said, if I want high read performance, then I don't need to evaluate Cassandra, which is not true. We've actually put a lot of work into the read performance, and with a bunch of optimizations we made in Cassandra 1.0, in typical workloads, read and write performance are about even. So we estimate you'll get about 6,000 operations per second per core. So we, on a four-core machine, we were pushing over 30,000 reads and writes per second. So, you know, to be conservative, 6,000 per core is about right. Netflix actually did some scaling evaluations, and they're doing a blog post about this soon. I don't know when you're going to air this, but the blog post will probably be out by the time you air this. That they took Cassandra from 16 nodes to 288 in EC2, and the performance was just this nice straight line up to slightly over a million writes per second at at the 288 nodes mark. And
Wow.
That's what actually a million logical writes, meaning that they're actually doing 3x replication. So it's actually 3 million physical writes per second.
Right. And that was another thing that I thought was really interesting about Cassandra, was that you could configure your replication factor and that kind of thing. Have you found that one replication factor, or a way of figuring out what that should be for your application, is there a good way of doing that, or do you just kind of have to guess and fiddle with it and figure that out?
Well, a good rule of thumb is to start with 3, and then you can kind of go from there if you need to do special cases. We have some customers who are very budget constrained. And so, for instance, one of them is running with 2 nodes in one data center and replication factor of 2 in one data center and replication factor of 2 in another. So a total of 4. Often what people will do as they add data centers is keep 3 replicas in each, which lets you tolerate failures in one data center without having to send clients all the way over the WAN link to the other data center to fail over.
Right.
And if you go from 2 to 3, then that lets you, not only does it mean I can tolerate 2 failures at consistency level 1, but it also means I can do data center local quorum operations, which let me provide a more stronger consistency guarantee to clients and say that, you know, you when you do a read at local quorum consistency level, I'll guarantee that you see the most recent version of any write that was also done at local quorum consistency level here.
Right. So I just want to, because there are some people that are really new to Cassandra and we kind of glossed over it, but basically my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm incorrect, but basically the replication factor is the number of copies that are kept in your cluster. And if I understand right, it's 1 copy per node that, you know, up to that replication factor. So if you have 5 servers and you have a replication factor of 3, then 3 of them will hold, any 3 of them can hold that data. And then your consistency factor is the number that have to respond with the same answer in order for the answer to be authoritative.
That's a good summary. Yeah.
So, basically this was another thing that really appealed to me about Cassandra, was just that, you know, I can basically set things up so that if I'm not as concerned about the consistency, you know, it's okay for me to get, you know, older data that's 2 or 3 or 4 versions ago, then I can just set my consistency factor to 1 and that's okay. But if I need the consensus, then I can set it to 2 or 3 and I can set my replication factor to 3 or 4, keeping in mind that, you know, it may take a little longer to read, but at the same time, I know I have the copies in my system so that if a node goes down, I'm not in a mess.
That's right. And you'll have those extra copies, you know, no matter what you do, set the consistency level to. If I'm doing a write with consistency level 1, you know, it will still do those other writes in the background, but it won't fail the write if some of them are down temporarily. So that's the main difference there.
Right. So it seems like Cassandra gets lumped in with a lot of the other NoSQL stuff. It seems like you've got this vast bucket that is NoSQL, which is basically anything that's not a relational database. And so people throw it in with Redis and Mongo and Couch and all these others. What is the main differentiating factor between Cassandra and some of these others?
That's a good question. And I think you've put your finger on a little bit of a sore spot there, which is that, you know, actually it was a coworker of mine at Rackspace who came up with the NoSQL term when we were, a fellow named Yuan Oskarson was putting together a conference on databases in San Francisco and wanted a tagline for it. And my coworker Eric Evans suggested NoSQL, and he's regretted it a little bit ever since. But I think it's valuable, especially at first, to highlight for people that you do have alternatives, and especially as data volumes are growing, relational databases aren't the best fit for a lot of these applications anymore. So it has been valuable, but then the flip side is that if you really do have to be aware that just not being a relational database is not a whole lot of commonality between a lot of these systems. You have Neo4j, which is a graph database, compared to CouchDB and MongoDB, which are document databases, and Voldemort, which is a key value database, and Cassandra, which is a column family database, which is kind of rows and columns, but with a little bit of a twist. And so yeah, there's definitely these differences there. So
Really interesting. Sorry to interrupt you. I think it's really interesting because, it seems like it's in the same vein of not a woman. And so you think about that and you think, well, that's pretty specific. It's a man. No, it could be a dog. It could be a tree. It could be grass. It could be a rock. It depends on, and so I think it's interesting that these all get lumped together by what they're not as opposed to what they are.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And to answer your question, what would I say sets Cassandra apart? Is I would say that we've that's actually kind of tough. but I would say there's two categories of NoSQL databases, and I won't say that Cassandra is the only one in the second category. But I would say that it's the most successful and is doing the best job at solving the problem. So the first category is, I would say, databases that started thinking about the world in terms of a single machine and coming up with their data model or their query language and going from there. And when you hit the scale wall, you say, well, okay, given all that I've done on the single machine side, how can I kind of duct taped my way around spanning multiple machines? And so firmly in the first camp, obviously, are things like relational databases, obviously, are the poster child there, where very limited success in spanning multiple machines, especially in the real-time side. You do have these big analytical warehouses. Those systems do a decent job of spanning multiple machines because they have much lower latency requirements than a system that's trying to serve millions of requests per second to live users driving an application somewhere.
Right, but most of those run off of master-slave replication of some kind.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them also involve large SANs as kind of a central point. Cassandra not down with either of those decisions, obviously.
Right.
So Cassandra is very much about the second category, which is we're going to design for scale first, and then we're going to try to add whatever features we can in without compromising that. So a good example would be, earlier this year, we added the ability to have indexes on columns. And you would say, well, wow, that's a really, really basic feature. How could you not have that for 2 years? And it's like, well, it took us a while to figure out how to add that in without compromising scale. That's, scale is feature number one for us. So some of the other databases, I said there's other ones in that category. Some of the other ones would be Voldemort, React from Basho. Those would be the main ones. HBase as well. Those would be the main ones, I think, in that category.
Right. So another question I have is, I've heard Cassandra being described as a column-based database, and that threw me for quite a while until I figured out how it worked. Do you want to explain why people call it that and what that means?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a tough one, because I said earlier that I would call it a column family database because I guess where people are saying when they're saying it's a column-based database is they're saying as opposed to Voldemort and Reoc, which are key value databases. And so Cassandra, you have a row key, but you also break that row down into columns. So a column is an atom of data rather than treating the row as something where to update a field in my user record, I would have to read that value back, that user blob, that serialized data. I would have to read that back, deserialize it, make my field change, serialize the whole thing, and then give it back to the database as a blob, effectively. You actually have two approaches that you can do with key value databases. One is that serialized blob approach, and then the other is to treat the fields as kind of subkeys. And so my key would be, one key would be J. Ellis, my username, tupled with email, my field. And that would be my key, that tuple. You can do that if you require that your underlying storage engine supports range scans. So you can say, give me all the keys that start with J. Ellis, and then you can get all those fields that belong with that back. Huh. And that second approach is what the new Oracle NoSQL product does. So they recently launched basically a Cassandra competitor, and that's the approach that they take with their system.
Huh. So what are the trade-offs then between reading the entire record versus just atomically managing each column?
That's a little outside the scope of my expertise, because Cassandra takes a different approach and says that, we're going to give you a row and column design as a fundamental building block of the storage engine. And so that not only does that give you, the efficient updates of being able to update just a little bit at a time, one field at a time, if that's what you need, but it actually allows us to do something else that's interesting. And this is why I like to say that it's a column family-based database, and not just it's a table-based database, because part of the column family model is that our storage engine is sparse. I mentioned that earlier to start with, but one of the implications of that is I can basically create columns at runtime without having to do an alter table. And where we use that, we announced Cassandra 07 at the beginning of the year, and the part of that announcement that got picked up on more than the rest was we announced that you can have up to 2 billion columns in a row. And so the reaction was, of course, why the hell would you do that? For a relational, someone with a relational background, that sounds completely wrong. That's not even wrong territory. But there's a method to the madness, which is that we allow you to materialize a query result into a row and basically pre-compute a materialized view for a given query. So for instance, in one of the toy data models we use when we're doing Cassandra training is we have a demo program called Twissandra. Twitter, as a toy built on a Cassandra engine. And so one of the questions we want to answer there is that, in fact, the central question that you're answering in a Twitter clone is, what are the tweets that my friends have made? And so in a relational system, you'd say, oh, that's easy. I'd say, select star from tweets, where user ID in subquery, select user ID from friends, where user equals me, right?
Yep.
So the problem is that, in these scale, in a distributed system, join is a dirty word. Because if I have, if I have 1,000 friends and each of them has on average 100 tweets, and those friends and those tweets live on different machines, man, that gets really slow, really fast.
Right.
Just because of the latency involved. So what we do instead is we say, well, I'm going to, every time someone makes a tweet, I'm going to go through each of his friends, and I'm going to have a separate column family. I'm going to have a column family called timeline to represent the tweets that everyone sees when he says, show me the tweets all my friends have made.
Right.
And every time someone makes a tweet, it will look up his friends, or rather the people who follow him, and put that tweet into each of their timeline rows. And Cassandra takes care of sorting that chronologically for you, so that when you go and say, show me the tweets that my friends have made, instead of doing, look up my friends and then join them with all their tweets, which is, potentially thousands of IO operations to pull that data into memory. It's just a single seek to the timeline row, pull out that data. It's already sorted for me. I don't even have to do that. And then I can give that to the user directly.
Right.
So what we're actually doing there is using our, write performance to make our read performance even that much better.
Right. And it's kind of an interesting and different way of thinking about it, but it's almost like pre-compiling your results before you return them to the user.
Right.
And, I read the Cassandra book, and I think it was based on 0.6, and it kept referring to 0.7's coming out with a feature like this. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's a mixed bag. So the O'Reilly book, Cassandra Definitive Guide, is exactly what you said. It's based on 0.6 with a mix of 0.7 thrown in. And in some cases, there's even some discussion of features that we had in an early 0.7 build, but then ripped it out because we realized it was a bad idea before 0.7 was released. So I'm afraid I can't endorse that book. But there is actually a book out by a guy named Ed Capriolo called Cassandra High Performance Cookbook.
Ooh.
And that's actually quite decent, and it's based on 0.8, which is the version right before 1.0, which we released a couple weeks ago. So basically all of the information in there is it's much more current. Of course there's new features where we haven't stood still. We added compression in 1.0 and some other features. But if you're going to pick up a book, I would recommend that one.
All right. Sounds good. I might have to pick it up myself. So my next question is you just released 1.0. You've talked about some of the features that are in it. What goes into your thought process of reaching the 1.0? Because 1.0 seems to be kind of a milestone that says, hey, this is ready for prime time. We've worked out most of the bugs. It's stable, yada, yada, yada. So what preparations do you have to make a 1.0 release?
It obviously, like you said, it's more of an art than a science. Different projects have their own rules. Of course, Linus recently took the Linux kernel to 3.x just because he felt that 36 or so revisions of 2.x was enough. So he's like, well, I just feel like it's 3.x now, so that's what we're going to do. And then you have projects like SQL Alchemy, for instance, which is a Python object relational mapper that I did some work on that I don't know if it's ever going to be 1.0 because, Mike, the project lead, just has, he's a bit of a perfectionist, which is a good thing, but... I don't know what his standards are, but they're extremely high. In the Cassandra case, we tried to take a balance and say that, we do want to send the signal that Cassandra is ready to be used in production. We've had people using it in production since 05. Actually, even earlier than that, I think OpenX has been using it since 03 in production.
Oh, wow.
The first one I would have deployed in production is 05, so that was kind of my line. And then what we've been doing since then, so basically with the earlier versions, you kind of had to know a lot about Cassandra's inner workings, or at least have someone on staff who did, to deploy it. And you needed to watch the Cassandra dev list and look out for any, basically know that, hey, if it runs out of memory, then these are the things that could cause that, and these are the dials I tweak and so forth. Scale was feature number one. In this case, user friendliness took a backseat to that for a while. So what we've been doing is we've been putting a lot of emphasis on making it so you don't have to be quite so much of an expert to use it in a production system. For instance, in 08, the release about 4 months ago, we put a lot of effort into having Cassandra self-tune its memory allocation for your different column families. Basically you tell it, I want you to use 2 gig of memory for that across the whole database, and not worry about having to say, I want column family users to get 50 megabytes and column family timeline to get 400. You don't have to worry about that. You just tell it, give it a lump sum and it will divide it up and tune it as it's needed. So that's the kind of thing that we wanted to get in and get solid before calling it 1.0.
All right. Sounds good. Now, I want to change tactics a little bit. You're the second person in 2 weeks that I've talked to that is on a team working on an Apache project that also co-founded a company that supports that project in one way or another. I was talking last week to Grant Ingersoll, and he works on Lucene and Solr, and mm-hmm. then he works for Lucid Imagination, I think is the name of his company. Mm-hmm. And co-founded DataStax, and you guys provide Cassandra. I don't know if you provide Cassandra support or if you just provide a setup where people can push their data to. You want to tell us a little bit about that company and how it came about?
Yeah, we're definitely on the product and services side of things. We don't do, for instance, we don't do hosted Cassandra, for instance. So we will help you run a Cassandra cluster, but we don't provide Cassandra in a cloud, for instance. Although we do know of some people working on that, but that's not something that we see as our mission particularly. So we do provide Cassandra support. We do Cassandra training. We recently released 1.0 of DataStax Enterprise, which is a data platform built on Cassandra that is more of a one-stop solution for big data. So what DataStax Enterprise does for you is, Cassandra is all about solving the real-time side of big data. And DataStax Enterprise allows you to do analytics against that as well. And so you can do, full SQL-based business intelligence queries, doing joins and so forth. It actually compiles those down to Hadoop MapReduce and separates those queries out, the analytical workload. It separates that away from the real-time side and runs it against a different set of replicas so they don't interfere with each other. It's very straightforward to get going. We put a lot of effort into the out-of-the-box experience and integrating it with OpsCenter, our monitoring and management tool for Cassandra and DataStax Enterprise. And we also released, alongside that, we released DataStax Community Edition, which is basically Cassandra plus a free version of OpsCenter. So totally free, you can use it in production. And that's one of the main pain points we've seen with Cassandra is that, hey, I'm not sure how to monitor this. I don't want to have to dig into all the JMX metrics you're exposing and set that up in Cacti or OpenNMS or whatever. So as part of part of what we want to do is increase Cassandra adoption, even if you're not going to pay us. So that's why we're doing DataStax Community and saying, hey, here's a free version of OpsCenter. Everyone should be using OpsCenter to monitor their Cassandra cluster, even if you're not paying us a dime. That's how important we think that is.
Right. Well, and it also makes sense to me from a business standpoint, because effectively what you're setting up is you need this kind of data. You need the availability and consistency that you get from Cassandra. And so, you know, your business is essentially Cassandra, and the larger it grows, the more business that you can find, because there will be people out there that get in, get used to what's out there, and then figure out real quick that they need somebody with a little more expertise and can come to you for it. At the same time, it benefits the community because we get a great tool that we can use to take advantage of this open source software. So it seems to me to be a win-win, and I love seeing when companies do this where they see an opportunity to contribute to the community, and at the same time, you know, it comes back to them and they benefit for it. You know, it's a great thing.
Thanks. And we do see that the companies with, you know, really critical applications do want to come to us and get a support contract or, you know, upgrade to DataStax Enterprise, and which, by the way, is also free to evaluate. So, of course. I lost my train of thought for a second there. You'd think I wouldn't do that, talking about money and stuff.
That's okay. I have another question. Maybe if you remember, you can come back to it.
Okay.
So I'm a little curious. It seems like there are a few companies out there that that build support around these open source projects. I mean, I've talked to people who professionally support all kinds of relational databases. I talked to the guys over at Lucid Imagination. I'm talking to you. How do you get the idea to start a company to do this kind of thing? Because, I mean, effectively, Cassandra doesn't cost anybody anything to get it, to set it up. Other than time or maybe employee time, which they're paying for. But, you know, effectively what you're doing is you're offering support for a free product.
Yeah, so the idea actually came out while I was at Rackspace. Rackspace's goal was, hey, we want a distributed database, a scalable database to use internally. And that was their goal. Helping other people, they wanted to be good open source citizens and so forth, but, you know, actually providing support to people, you know, wasn't really on their roadmap. Where the idea first kind of hit me was when we were talking to a company that they had been evaluating Cassandra and then eventually ended up deploying Reoc instead. And I asked one of their engineers, this was about 2 years ago, I asked one of their engineers, what happened? You know, it looked, you know, from where I stood, it looked like Cassandra was a better fit for you, better performance, better fit on the data model side. And he's like, yeah, you know, it really was. But, Basho's there behind Reoc. We could go to them, get a support contract. And that really mattered to my boss. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of hit my competitive streak a little bit, you know, uh-huh. I don't want people to not be able to use Cassandra because there's nobody there to sell them a support contract. So that kind of planted the seed. And so it was about 5 months later that Matt File and I actually founded DataStax. It felt like, you know, the right place at the right time. There was demand for it that we were seeing just from our exposure in the community. So we went ahead and pulled the trigger.
That makes sense. Yeah, it seems like I'm getting into a little bit, and you should know a lot of the guys over at Instructure that's here in Salt Lake, because most of them went from Mozy to Instructure, and Josh actually is their CEO. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so I've kind of been following their product, and they open sourced their product. Of course, they have the one that they host and run for the universities and stuff. and it's called Canvas. And anyway, so people run into snags with the open source version, and they're not really offering support for it, so I've been picking some of that up. And I can kind of see how you'd get started with that, but, you know, especially as it gets bigger and bigger, you know, you'd be able to build a company around supporting the open source software there. So, yeah, that's exciting, and it sounds like you guys are doing great stuff over there, and so I'm really excited for you and for all the things that you've got going on. I have one last question for you before we wrap this up, and that is when I was working with you at Mozy, you seemed to be really into Python.
And Cassandra's written in Java.
That's right, and so I was going to ask you, how has it been switching over to Java?
It's funny. Actually, one of the places that contacted me after I left Mozy was the Amazon S3 team. And I said, but you guys are Java-based is what I hear. And they said, yeah, that's right. It's a full-time Java position. So I said, not interested, sorry. and here I am working on a Java-based database. But, you know, it really is. So what we were doing at Mozy, I was working on the storage engine there, and it was really an IO-bound system. And so using something like Python, it's not a big deal. You know, the IO in Python is a fairly thin layer over C. So we weren't really giving up a whole lot by doing that in Python. And the advantage of development speed was a huge win in that respect. But with something like Cassandra, if you're not, in a system like this, with your goal is to not be IO bound. You want your hot data set to fit in memory, and at that point, you become CPU bound. And if your cluster is big enough, you might be network bound. But generally, you're CPU bound. And so Python is just not fast enough. We see, we actually have a real world demonstration of that because our first version of the Cassandra stress tool, our benchmark, I wrote that in Python. And when we switched, what we found is we needed too many client machines to stress a Cassandra cluster and really push it to its limit. So we rewrote that in Java, and the performance was literally 10 times as fast in Java than it was in Python. So it's really a better fit for this kind of application.
Yeah. So I guess my other question then is, has it been painful to switch to Java, or have you kind of gotten accustomed to it and like it now? And, you know, what was your initial reaction when you started working on it and had to switch over to something like Java? Because the two languages are quite a bit different.
They are quite a bit different. I do think that they share some important parts of philosophy, which is that, one of the core of the Zen of Python is that there should be preferably only one way to do something, right? So contrasting with something like Perl, or with Ruby, or on the compiled side, something like Scala or C++. And Java shares that philosophy. So in some important respects, Java and I get along like that. Now, every time I reach for a generator function and realize I can't do that in Java, or I want to do a closure and realize I have to use an inner class, which is ugly as sin in Java, yeah, I do wince a little bit. But Java definitely has its good points as well. You know, things like the Google Guava libraries, which have insanely useful collection support, things like the non-blocking hash map and other concurrent data structures that you get in the Java ecosystem. You know, they're really, Java had these things 5 years ago, which is probably, 10 years ahead of most of the other ecosystems out there. So, because in the concurrent design department, there's no contest. Java is miles ahead of Python.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming onto the podcast. I really appreciate it. And it's good to catch up with somebody that I actually know. So we'll keep tabs on what's going on at DataStax and with Cassandra, and congratulations on the 1.0 release and the DataStax Enterprise release.
Thanks, Charles. It's been good talking with you.
Yeah, you too.